According to the latest data from the U.S. Census Bureau analyzed by the Brookings Institution, only 20% of U.S. households are considered traditional families, that is, married couples with children. This is a sharp contrast from the 43% of such families in 1950. It's a brave new world with brave new family structures. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, our Cash Money Click of personal finance experts discusses the tax implications, estate planning, insurance, and other financial considerations for non-traditional couples. As financial advisors carefully consider the changing regulatory landscape, we'll look at the challenges and benefits of a viable financial plan for your household. That's on Central Standard after this hour's NPR News. Domestic partner can mean just about anything these days. Your man, your woman, your brother, your sister, extended family, even your grown-up child or equally grown-up parents. Indeed, the nuclear family was more common in the nuclear age. Financial needs, however, haven't changed much. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Today we examine the financial management methods, tips, and tricks of the trade for non-traditional couples with our Cash Money Click. That's right, our Cash Money Click is in the house to help you manage cash for the people that are in your house. David Jackson of Waddell & Reed, Dan Matthews of Stepan Rothwell, and Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services. They're all members of the Financial Planning Association for Greater Kansas City. Welcome to the studio, gentlemen.
Hey, great to be here.
And also joining us is J.T. Hatfield-Charles, an ambassador for the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards. He's calling in this morning from Rockville, Maryland. Mr. Charles, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you. Good morning.
Now, how do you define non-traditional households, Mr. Charles?
Well, there's actually three different subsets, if you will, of non-traditional households. The first one is going to be more or less your Gen X, the new generation that are probably coming together and trying out a relationship before marriage. The second one is typically going to be your baby boom generation, and that's going to be everything from an individual that never got married, maybe someone who's got a divorce or someone who has lost their partner, so they're a widow or a widower, and now maybe they're looking to cohabitate for companionship, so they don't have the sanctity of marriage necessarily, but they have the relationship. And the third subset of that is going to be your LGBT or your gay and lesbian community, which is not recognized under federal law for marriage and in most states.
What have been your experiences with non-traditional couples that sort of run the gamut of what you just described?
More or less, it's the planning strategies that come into play. You know, you have to look at, you know, some states are offering same-sex marriage now. Other states might offer civil unions or domestic partnerships, and you have many states that offer no protection whatsoever. So what we have is planning on the state level based on what opportunities are available, but then we also have to recognize that on the federal level, you know, these couples are nothing more than legal strangers. So it's a matter of taking the state planning and the federal planning and making sure that everything is working in concert. But there are so many intricacies that go along the way that you have to make sure that you're really getting in and providing the protections for our clients.
Legal strangers is an interesting comparison or interesting label to put on it. David Jackson, what have been your experiences with non-traditional couples or legal strangers?
Well, you know, one of the big ones I would say would be Social Security. You know, so you've got a couple that have been together for maybe years. And, you know, as a spouse, as a married couple, they are entitled to each other's benefits. But as a non-married couple, they're not. So that's one of the frequent ones that we see out there.
Mr. Hatfield-Charles, how are the needs of a non-traditional family the same as the needs of a so-called traditional family? And how are they different?
Well, you know, let me actually start with the second part of the question. And if you'll give me about 30 to 45 seconds, I'll kind of walk you through just, you know, the
you
planning
have 10
intricacies.
Seconds.
All right, let me walk quickly then.
No, go ahead.
I can talk fast. I'm East Coast. Think about, you know, something just as simple as investments. You know, you question, you wonder, what could possibly be different in this world? But something as simple as investments, which tie into tax, estate planning, et cetera, you know, what tax bracket are the two couples in? They don't necessarily get to go out and do one joint tax return, and if they do, because they get the sanctities of legal marriage on the state level, now how do we do that on the federal level? But more so, you know, what tax brackets are they in? How do they run their finances? You know, what criteria should we be looking at in order to give one type of investment to one individual versus the other? How does all this tie into estate planning? You know, what's the titling of the account so that, Lord forbid, we're in a position where we're not able to make decisions for ourselves, either through incapacitation or we predecease our partner? Who gets to step in and make those decisions? Without marriage, we don't have those things clear-cut, so we have to have the right documentation. You know, something as simple as a mortgage, or who gets the tax deductions for real estate taxes, or how we're looking at retirement. You know, we had a great example just a second ago about Social Security. You know, we plan for retirement, but what happens if one of the two partners passes away, and now all of a sudden we don't get a survivorship benefit or the ongoing income stream that comes from either Social Security or someone's pension? All of these things tie in into complexities or challenges that, you know, the traditional married spouse doesn't have to deal with.
You're raising all the questions that will come up throughout this hour that we will address in summary. Let's bring in Dan Matthews. What are the challenges for domestic partnerships or non-traditional families? How have those challenges changed or abated in modern times?
One of the biggest challenges is this whole idea that federal law doesn't recognize these couples as being married, and so therefore they're not afforded some of the benefits that married couples receive. For example, on the estate tax side, a married couple, the two of those individuals can give each other gifts throughout their lifetime that are unlimited. Whereas if you're an unmarried couple living like you're married, but you're not married under federal law, then you can't make those kind of gifts, and so that creates some planning challenges that you have to address, and there also could create some estate tax or gift tax issues that you may fall into, whereas a married couple wouldn't have to face those issues.
Bringing in Alex Petrovic, healthcare and financial power of attorney documents are critical if the partner is the one who wants to make the financial decisions for their other partner or vice versa. What are the differences between durable and springing powers of attorney?
Well, springing is something that becomes if something happens, and I'm not an attorney, so I want to be careful how I describe this. And durable is something that's already in place, and I think that, again, that's part of the documentation process that is so important here. I would say that leads this whole discussion, really.
Is that documentation process and its preparation different with non-traditional couples?
Sure, because there's a lot more that's left unwritten in the code of law. So that process is, and it's not, even though you might have some documents, they may or may not be recognized in the same state or if you have property in a different state. But I would add that I think that what's different now than maybe previously is that more people are seeking out help in terms of maybe estate planners and lawyers and so forth. So I think there is some difference what's going on in all the communities about trying to document stuff and how to do it legally. I think more people are proactive or at least thinking in those terms than they used to.
Along those terms, J.T. Hadfield-Charles, how do you get around the bureaucracy or, quite frankly, the lack of paperwork that even exists in the first place for these types of couples or families?
You know, what a great transition. You're actually setting me up for a comment that I wanted to throw in there. Thank you. Something as simple as a power of attorney, which, you know, if you think of financial institutions, typically if you have a power of attorney that's more than 6 months old, financial institutions will typically shy away, and especially if you're not in an area that's going to recognize the relationship. What I like to recommend to a lot of my clients is actually go back and go to the institutions in which you have accounts and ask for their internal power of attorney. This is a document that they're familiar with the wording, and these are things that are going to go on in perpetuity unless you actually retract that power of attorney. So a couple of thoughts. One, go to your financial institution, get their power of attorney that's on file so you don't have future challenges. Two, when you're doing your power of attorney, find out if you have a state-mandated power of attorney that has to be accepted by any institution in that state. And then three, back it up with a very detailed power of attorney as far as what you would like, and then kind of tying in what we were just talking about, make sure that you're using the right type of power of attorney, whether it be durable, which goes into effect immediately, or a springing, which only is in a full effect if you're incapacitated or doctors are certifying that you're not able to make decisions for yourself.
J.T. Hadfield-Charles, just so you know, I am the setup man.
That's your job, huh?
What should be your first priority if you're a non-traditional couple sitting down for the first time to plan your financial life? Let's start with David Jackson.
Well, you want to be thinking about what happens if And, you know, I wanted to piggyback on something Dan was talking about, because I've got a perfect example where I was working with a couple that they had a teenage daughter, and they had been together 20-plus years. He died unexpectedly and left an estate of about, let's say, like $3 million, I think it was, or something like that. If they had been married, that whole estate would have gone over to the wife with no tax consequences at all. But in this particular case, because they weren't married, it was subjected to a huge estate tax bill. So in this particular case had a happy ending in that we found an attorney that was able to work some things out. But, you know, that's a big concern for a couple.
Alex Petrovic?
Well, I think that I would agree with David, but it's to ask specific questions of what their goals are. How do they want this to happen? How do they want that to happen, whether it's financial or if it's family and whatnot? It's to establish those goals, no different in really any relationships that we work with people, but it's to understand exactly what their goals are, so then you can try to develop those plans that would accomplish those goals.
Dan Matthews had something to add.
Yeah, I think one of the most important questions to ask is, whose money is it? When you're looking at a couple, who owns what? What's mine, what's yours, what's ours? And getting that information down and getting the factual information there, that's really important to starting the planning process of determining, you know, what do we want to hold jointly? What do we want to hold in individual ownership? Because as JT alluded to earlier, there's a lot of questions that come up regarding income taxes, estate, and gift taxes, and whatnot, that you have to go through that, know that information first before you can start the process of providing financial planning.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are the Cash Money Clique of financial advisors, David Jackson of Waddell & Reed, Dan Matthews of Step & Rothwell, and Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services. They are all members of the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City, respectively. Also joining us is JT Hatfield Charles, an ambassador for the Certified Financial Planner, or CFP, Board of Standards. He's calling in this morning from his home in Rockville, Maryland. Kansas City, if you're living in a domestic partnership of any kind, gay or straight, siblings or parents, extended family, we'd like to hear from you about your experiences in financial planning. The number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Once again, the subject today is financial planning for non-traditional families. You can write in your thoughts and questions to our Cash Money Click at centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is an option as well, and you can tweet us at KCURCST. JT Hatfield, Charles, when you think of domestic partnerships or non-traditional families, they can encompass many things. It can be a same-sex couple or an unmarried heterosexual couple or some guy who had to stay with his uncle and ended up staying there 10 years. How do you differentiate this?
Well, the planning for the three opportunities that you're giving are just about the same, depending on what the goals are. And, you know, it's something I'm going to tie into the last conversation we had. When planning for any non-traditional or unmarried couples, whatever the dynamic of the relationship is, I think the most important thing to recognize is you don't know what you don't know. And, you know, Alex, Dana, and David really gave some good facets about things that we have to be thinking about when we're doing planning for these relationships. But I'm going to actually take it a step back and say, you know, there are so many intricacies, and when this is my plug for the CFP Board of Standards. When you're working with financial planning, you have everything from tax to investment to estate to insurance planning, and many other facets. And what we have to do is, across the board, figure out what our clients' goals are, and then come back and make sure that all of these segments of planning or intricacies of planning are working together. You know, when you're dealing with DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act, we have 1,138 rights, protections, and privileges that are taken away from these couples. So we have to make sure that we're giving whatever we can, or giving the proper planning to give the protections that aren't naturally afforded to them.
It's interesting that you bring up DOMA and the public legislation that is before the Supreme Court. How is the Certified Financial Planning Board of Standards addressing these types of standards on a private sector level? How are you?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, that was the question.
A lot of it is going into the education, and I go back to the CFP designation or credential is, in my opinion, the most comprehensive planning credential or education system that's out there. From this, you're getting all the core requirements, and you're learning not only the basics across those different disciplines of financial planning, but you're also learning how to cross-pollinate them. From that, you can actually sit down with the non-traditionally unmarried couples, figure out what their goals are, as Alex, Dan, and David were mentioning earlier, and actually be able to give the proper planning or structures. But I'm going to take it a step further and say it's not only up to the financial advisor in this regard. Again, we have to recognize that there are so many specialties and subspecialties with that 1,138 rights, obligations, and protections that we don't have. You have to work with the CPAs and the estate planning attorneys directly and make sure everything is flowing in concert so the right protections are actually being put in place.
Let's talk a little bit about what goes on back in the household. Dan Matthews was mentioning early, the question is, whose money is it? So along those lines, Dan, what is a domestic partner agreement and why is it important?
Well, it's essentially like a prenuptial agreement that a married couple would have. And you're outlining all kind of, you know, what you own and your expectations in the relationship regarding the finances, as well as maybe the house. And also it tracks what you contribute to things like maybe how much you put into the house. And so those are things that if you document those at the beginning of the relationship, then those things are kind of set in stone, and you can move forward from that knowing that you're all in agreement on this on these particular issues, and there's no questions down the road. And essentially, you can also do that with just like, you know, you were talking about living with your uncle. You know, you can have an agreement set up with somebody just to kind of outline these living conditions under which you're going to have with this particular person. So there's a lot of things you just documenting that make perfect sense.
And this is not a pinky swear, David Jackson, or a spit handshake. This is a actual legal document.
Yeah, it's a legal contract, you know, and it is an agreement. And it's important to get things up front. In a lot of cases, just who's going to pay what, you know, what happens if this relationship dissolves or whatever, you know, just having it in writing just simplifies life.
We're talking about financial planning for non-traditional couples and non-traditional families, which can run the whole gamut. Call in and tell us about your experiences with financial planning with your partner or with your uncle. Lions, tigers, and bears, oh my, etc. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write in your thoughts and questions to centralstandard@kcur.org. Facebook is an option as well. Tweet us at KCURCST. Let's go to Amy in Kansas City. Amy, welcome to Central Standard. Amy? We don't have Amy. So we do have J.T. Hatfield-Charles. Tax planning, J.T., seems to be a pretty pertinent issue. How can a non-traditional family work out who's going to be a dependent and who's going to claim who?
I wish I had the time to actually go through the opportunities for what it takes to claim as a dependent. But what I'll offer is we in the non-traditional planning, you don't necessarily have the opportunity to file as married filing jointly. But there might be an opportunity, depending on how the household finances are run, to either do head of household or to claim your partner as a dependent. What I'm going to offer is there are special rules with regard to, you know, where the dependent lives, whether they're a student, potentially a divorced spouse, and what the income levels are. And you have to be very, very careful with this. And I'm going to tie back in and say this is definitely someplace that you want to be working with a CPA to get the tax advice on this, because if it's not done just right, you can lose out on some of the tax-free income or the benefits that go along with the standard deduction and the personal exemption. And if you're in a community property state, all bets are off. I shouldn't say that, but to get a dependent status is going to be even harder. My point to this is when it comes to tax planning, we have two different tax returns that we can leverage. So there's a lot of opportunities where, depending on what the income is for the partners and what the goals are, how they run their finances, is everything mine and mine, or is everything ours, or do we have mine, yours, and ours? Depending on what the structures are, we can play with different types of deductions, whether it be charitable deductions, medical expenses, miscellaneous itemized deductions, or even, you know, in the state of Maryland, we have challenges with rental property. If someone makes more than $100,000 as an adjusted gross income, they lose the opportunity to take any losses on a rental property. So by being able to play with, again, depending on titling and how we run our household, being able to play with two different tax returns, we might be able to uncover losses or gains that we might not have otherwise been able to use.
So can you match deductions with a higher income partner, per se?
Yes, you actually want to structure that way when possible. And while not appropriate for everybody, it's often a lot easier if we have joint assets or joint accounts, because then we can flip. For instance, if in the state of Maryland, same-sex marriage is legal. So if my husband at the end of the year in his account has a crazy amount of long-term capital gains, and maybe I have some long-term capital losses, we might either do a joint return where I can leverage some of his gains to offset my losses, or depending on, you know, maybe I'm subject to this thing called alternative minimum tax, where if the IRS doesn't get you under the regular tax schedule, they come back and do an alternative calculation and try and find other ways to get you. If I'm in a place where I would be subject to certain types of taxes because of my income or the way my tax return flows, then maybe it makes more sense for me to have certain things funnel, like municipal bonds or something, funnel on his tax return as opposed to mine.
Sounds like you got this really figured out, JT.
It can be a lot of fun. It's just a matter of, again, working with those tax professionals or those estate professionals to make sure you're not giving up those opportunities. You don't know what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Leverage your CFPs, your certified financial planners, or your professionals out there to make sure that you're getting every bang for your buck that's available to you.
Dan Matthews, what do you do in Missouri or Kansas if your husband, wife, or a partner is not a certified financial planner?
Well, certainly seek out a certified financial planner, as JT was saying, as a fellow ambassador. I certainly agree with that. In Kansas and Missouri, we don't recognize same-sex marriages. So
you have
to play the individual income tax game, in essence. We're not playing under two sets of rules like a state that would recognize same-sex marriages. So you have to look at each individual's situations and then file and do a projection like, you know, file me as individual versus joint. And then just be careful, you know, when JT talked about kind of moving deductions or income, just make sure that, as JT said, contact a CPA, because there are rules around, you know, who can take a deduction. For instance, the mortgage interest deduction, a very popular deduction, and homeowners enjoy that, can take that. You know, who's on the mortgage? Who owns the house? Because if you're not on the mortgage and you don't own the house, then you're not legally eligible to take the deduction. So you have to be very careful about how you're doing this.
We're going to go to Ian in Kansas City, Missouri. Ian, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi. I'm just a little curious about what an obstacle or process you would like to change or expedite if to help these people out.
Can you clarify your question? I'm not sure.
These people have all these obstacles that they have to overcome on the financial planning side, and what sort of obstacle or process that they have to go through, in your commenter's experience, would they change or speed up to help them?
What obstacles do these people have to go through, Joshua Hatfield?
Ian, it's a great question, and it kind of goes back to the disciplines that I was describing earlier. You know, one simple item, you know, you think you go to a financial advisor because you have a question about maybe a stock or an investment that you inherited, but really when it comes down to it, you know, how should that, and this is just a spread out, Ian, and offer, you don't know what you don't know, and there are so many complexities with any one subject, but you take that one investment account, you know, how should it be set up? Should it be in individual name? Should it be in joint name? Well, maybe you decide that you want to have this with your partner, but at the same time, depending on the value of it, if you put it in joint name, now all of a sudden you created a potential gift tax. You know, take it a step further. If we put it in joint name and our partner decides that he wants to go off to Las Vegas and cash that account out, we've lost control of that asset and it's gone. You know, when we go to sell...
What's
the tax implication going to be? Or all the way down to, you know, if you become incapacitated or something happens to one of you, where is that asset going to go? Do you want that asset to end up in probate, perhaps, if you were to pass away and maybe it doesn't go to your partner because your third cousin twice removed comes in and says, you know what, Uncle Ian said I was supposed to have that asset. So it's not just one item, Ian, unfortunately. It's so many different things that come together that you have to really look at the big spectrum or the broad spectrum to figure out how every little piece is going to play out and make sure everything works in concert together. I keep saying that word, in concert, today.
Uncle Ian, do you have any questions about your financial challenges?
No, I'm not in this situation myself. So no, I I'll let other people ask those questions.
So I think the answer here is there is no one way to expedite this gauntlet.
It's so many issues. You know, one of the big ones I want to talk about is the retirement issue, since we focus a lot on retirement planning for our clients. So let's just say a client is ready to retire, and they have a partner, you know, but they're not married, male or female, doesn't matter. But they're receiving that pension, and if they die, can they pass that pension on? You know, as a spouse, maybe they can. With a non-spouse, maybe they can't.
Our guests are Cash Money Click of Financial Advisors, David Jackson, whose voice you just heard. He's from Waddell & Reed. Dan Matthews of Stepan Rothwell is here, as is Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services. They're all members of the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. And also joining us on the phone from Rockville, Maryland, is J.T. Hatfield-Charles, who's an ambassador for the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards. As I mentioned, he's calling in from Maryland. We're going to take a quick break. When we return, more of the particulars of financial management for non-traditional couples with our Cash Money Click. Kansas City, if you're living in a domestic partnership of any variety, gay or straight, siblings or parents, extended family, we'd like to hear from you about your experiences in financial planning. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Facebook is also an option. You can also write in thoughts and questions to centralstandard@kcur.org. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall. It's often said that you don't choose family, but you can choose how to handle your family's finances. We're talking about financial planning and management tips for non-traditional families on today's program. Our guests are the Cash Money Click of Financial Advisors, David Jackson of Waddell & Reed, Dan Matthews of Stepan Rothwell, and Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services. They're all members of the Financial Planning Association for Greater Kansas City. And also joining us is J.T. Hatfield-Charles. He's an ambassador for the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, the CFP Board of Standards. He's calling in from Rockville, Maryland. Kansas City, if you're living in a domestic partnership of any kind, gay or straight, siblings or parents or extended family, your uncle, Bob or Robert, whatever he prefers to be called, give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write in your thoughts and questions to Central Standard at KCUR.org or tweet us at KCURCST. Let's go to Debbie in Olathe. Debbie, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
No problem.
What about using a living trust where the one person is trustee of the estate but everything goes to the survivor as the trust directs. And that includes the house, the cars, the municipal bonds, virtually everything but an IRA. It works very well in our family. My father was the trustee of his own estate, and I was the trustee. And after he died, I managed the estate and kept my mother well and in her own home. And then after she died, everything was already directed to go directly divided among our four siblings, and there was no probate, and it was a clean sweep, and we were done, although it did take time.
Thank you very much, Debbie, for your contribution to the conversation. That sounds simple enough. Can non-traditional couples do that? It seems like anybody can do that.
Yeah, absolutely, and they are a good tool to use in these particular cases. A living trust is basically a setup where you have three parties, a grantor, which actually owns the assets that are placed into trust, a trustee, which will be the decision maker regarding those assets, and then a beneficiary who will eventually receive the assets after an event. And these trusts can be used to avoid unintended beneficiaries. And in these cases where if you don't have an estate plan set up, if you go through the intestate process or you die without a will, your estate will be at the hands of state laws, which generally, like I said, go to your third cousin removed and may not go to your partner, which is what you would like to have happened.
Unintended beneficiaries. That's a very funny phrase.
Well, I had my brother-in-law went through that recently where his dad was living with a young lady and he died unexpectedly. And my brother-in-law expected that he would receive the house and, some of the proceeds, but became a big battle between him and his brothers and the girlfriend as to how things were divided. And it could have all been settled really simply if he had just done a little estate planning. And so, you know, the bottom line is you really need to sit down and talk to somebody, because the issues for a non-traditional family, it's the same for a traditional. It's what are your goals, what are your objectives, and then putting things in place. But then as a non-traditional family, you're going to have to take those extra steps to make things happen the way you want them to, because it's not automatic. You know, it's like if I make a decision on my pension, my wife has to sign off on it, and it has to be notarized saying she agrees with it. If she's not my wife, she doesn't get a say. And maybe that's fair, maybe it's not. But.
Is that fair, Joshua Hatfield Charles?
Personally, I am a big advocate of avoiding probate or losing the opportunity to actually have your wishes come to fruition. You know, Debbie brought up a great strategy, which is basically you set up this trust, which is more or less a wrapper that you're going to put around an investment account. Once you put that wrapper around it, you're in control of the asset for as long as you want to, but as soon as you become incapacitated or pass away, there's a preset defined set of rules that you've created, basically saying how that money is going to funnel. Revocable living trusts are great, and I would offer that, in my opinion, the only two negatives to a revocable living trust are going to be the cost to set it up and then the administrative function of actually titling the assets into the trust. Outside of that, it's a win-win-win across the board, because it's a private transfer of assets. You get to control them even after the grave based on the decisions you've made in the trust. But more or less, or more importantly, it's something that you don't really have the opportunity to contest. If you think about, I'm going to use a nasty word called probate for a second. Anything we have in our own individual name when we pass away goes into this pot called probate. And probate should be a very efficient process where basically all probate is you have a judge who's going to read your will, figure out where the assets are supposed to go, and eventually they'll go on to the beneficiaries. But before they get released onto the beneficiaries, we get two people or two entities that get to come back and contest. You have the family members, even that second cousin twice removed, or creditors. Maybe that the person died as a result of a car accident, and there's a lawsuit against the estate. So all those assets can actually get eaten up before they go to the beneficiary, or they go to that unintended beneficiary because a judge comes back and says, you know what, I'm not recognizing this legal stranger as the beneficiary. You're right. Second cousin twice removed should get the asset. So whenever possible and appropriate, I like to try and avoid that probate pot altogether. And you can do it through a revocable living trust. You can do it by having defined beneficiary designations. And I'm going to offer, you know, we have so many employers still to date that haven't updated their retirement plans, but you should now be able to list your partner, your domestic partner, your civil union, whatever your relationship is. You should be able to list anybody you want as a beneficiary now, but you should have either transfer on death beneficiary designations or a revocable living trust when possible to try and avoid that probate challenge.
J.T. Hatfield Charles, when you talk about putting a wrapper around the living will and trust, I just want to clarify that you don't mean bringing in somebody to the will reading to rhyme on a microphone.
No.
I just want to clarify that. You mean legal protection, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Correct. Think of the trust as nothing more than a wrapper that's going to go around an investment account. And Debbie gave several.
Right. Sorry. Let's bring it into the domestic planning a little bit as we explore some of the stuff from the callers and what they're going to say. What about cash flow and allocation planning? How do we start with that? J.T. Hatfield?
Well, this is going to go back to how do we run our household? Are assets mine and yours, or are assets yours, mine, and ours, or is everything just ours? And depending on what it is that we're trying to accomplish, you know, are we running our finances separately? And whether we're married or not married, I've seen different relationships where they thrive one way or the other. You have to figure out what the goals are first. You know, is there an income disparity? Do we have to be careful to make sure that we don't have one person who's contributing more than $13,000 to the household than the other? Also, how are we titling our assets? But once we can get that core and what their goals are as far as how are we going to manage our household, well, from there, we might be able to step out and figure out better how, you know, maybe one person's going to pay the mortgage because of tax benefits and the other one's going to pay for, you know, expenses, cable, phone, electricity, whatever the case may be. What I like to try and see is, especially when we have two individual household accounts, if you will, I like to see, you know, maybe a yours and a mine account, but maybe then a joint household account where we're putting all the expenditures in for the mortgage, the utilities, all that other stuff. And at the end of the year, we can come back and we can make the decision, you know, did you pay the mortgage or did I, based on what tax benefits you might be able to get from that. Now here, I'm going to go back. I know Dan's going to jump in just a second and give the disclosure. Make sure you're working with your CPA on this stuff, because you need to have certain types of consistency, and you need to make sure you have the right titling and documentation along the way.
We have Bob in Jackson County, which is funny because I mentioned a hypothetical Uncle Bob or Uncle Robert at the beginning of the broadcast. One word, clairvoyance. Bob, Jackson County, welcome to Central Standard.
Yeah, I live with my in-laws, and, you know, they're getting up there in age, and the house is both in my wife's and their names. Is there something we should be preparing for them?
Go ahead, Bob.
Is there going to move off of the a title as they die off, or how will that work, or are we going to be in trouble?
This is a case of a non-traditional family living with the in-laws, buying a house together. How does this work? Alex Petrovic?
Well, first off, I mean, that needs to have a family meeting, number one, because maybe the parents don't want the in-law, the son-in-law, on there. I mean, just throwing out hypotheticals. I mean, you need a family meeting to determine what the goal of the owners are. So that would be our first place to start.
Bob, are you thinking about having a family meeting?
No, yeah. We've had it, actually. We're all on the titles and everything. We've been living together for almost 20-some years.
All of you.
So, yes. It's a big house. It's a really big house. And we just want to make sure that, you know, here as they get older and where we should be doing to get everything straightened out.
JT Hatfield. Go ahead. Yeah, I was just about to come to you. Clairvoyance.
I know. Clairvoyance. Here we go. Bob, one thing I'm going to offer, or two things I'm going to offer for you are, one, make sure you have the right protections in place with the homeowner's policy, depending on how the title is structured. And I'm going to get into the different types of titling in a second. But you want to make sure that you have the right types of homeowner's insurance and make sure that all couples involved are actually protected under the homeowner's policy. Sometimes you actually have to have a renter's policy if you don't have the right type of title. So that's part one. Part two is you should also have this thing called an umbrella liability policy, which basically says, you know, you've got your homeowner's policy and you have your auto policies. An umbrella liability policy goes around the home and the auto and gives you increments of about $1 million of additional protection. And out in your area, you're probably looking at about $150 to $200 a year per $1 million of coverage. But you got to keep in mind that that house, if one of the in-laws or the family members gets in a car accident or something else, again, with that joint titling, you might have a liability challenge attached to that house. So that's one. Just make sure you work with your homeowners, your property and casualty agent, to make sure you have the right protection. The second thing, though, is I'm going to encourage you to check and see what kind of joint title you have. Do you have something called tenants in common, or do you have something called with rights of survivorship? Tenants in common, you know, imagine, Bob, that you and I go out and buy a beach house. We find this great place, and when we buy that house, whatever amount of money we both put down, with tenants in common, if I were to die, my portion of that house goes down based on my will. So if I leave that house to my 18-year-old brother who likes to throw kegger parties, guess what you're doing on weekends, Bob, with my little brother? With rights of survivorship, it basically says if you and I buy that same house, or if we have multiple people to buy the house, if one person passes away, then all the other people on that title get that portion of it. So what you want to make sure is, in the big picture, is that you don't have that tenants in common where all of a sudden you now own the house with the in-laws family or whoever they leave their portion to.
That's a good point. Bob, are you able to clarify which one of these types of wills that you have?
Well, I'm sure going to find out here shortly.
Good move.
That's the purpose of the show, because you don't want to be throwing keggers with someone you don't want to be throwing keggers
right.
with.
And that's rights of survivorship.
With JT's little brother.
Rights of survivorship versus... Tenants in common. Right.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much, Bob, for calling in. Thank you. And we're going to go to Darren in St. Joe. Welcome to Central Standard, Darren.
Hi. Thank you. My situation is this. My girlfriend and I have been together for 6 years. We have a child together. She has children from a previous marriage. We do not live together. I am the sole heir to my father's estate. And my concern is that in the event of his passing and or my passing, will she have any legal claim to his estate, which in the event of my passing, our mutual son is the only beneficiary?
Can someone address that?
Yeah, and you do have to set up some planning for this particular situation. Now, whether or not she would have legal rights to your father's estate that he's leaving to you, if you're not married, I don't know. You'd probably have to check with an attorney. I don't think so. But
Probably not,
yeah. But in terms of protecting your son's interest and you're not married to your girlfriend, in that case, then you may want to look at something like a trust, and that if you're not around to make decisions, that somebody can make decisions on your behalf and make those decisions that are in the best interest of your son. So maybe protecting those assets through a trust, because you don't know what's going to happen with the relationship, obviously, you know. So you just have to plan for those contingencies.
Yeah, because your big vulnerability there is your son that you had with her. If something happens to you, then she more than likely is going to have some control over his assets to some extent.
Exactly.
So.
Yeah, you probably want that, that she'd be able to make those decisions. But whether or not you want her to actually be able to use the assets for her benefit, that's another question that you have to think about.
We're talking about financial planning for non-traditional couples here on Central Standard today. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm Jabalani LaFall. Our guests are our Cash Money Click of Financial Advisors, David Jackson of Waddell & Reed, Dan Matthews of Stepan Rothwell, and Alex Petrovic of Petrovic Financial Services. They're all members of the Financial Planning Association of Greater Kansas City. Also joining us is J.T. Hatfield-Charles, an ambassador for the Certified Planner Board of Standards. He's calling in this morning from his home in Rockville, Maryland. JT, what if you have a same-sex couple where one partner has a child from a previous marriage? How does he protect what he wants to leave to his new partner and what he wants to leave to what will eventually be his adult child?
Great question. And actually, I'm going to tie this into the last conversation in which Darren was on. I'm going to point out, first of all, that, Darren, we had mentioned this thing called a domestic partnership earlier on. Great opportunity to use something like that, because it's going to not only – I'm sorry, let me back up. Domestic partnership agreement in Darren's situation can actually help determine what the guardianship, or who should be able to step in as the guardian should something happen to Darren. It's probably going to be the child's mother, but we need to clarify that. But the second thing is if we're not living together and we're concerned about anything in the future, we might also want to make sure that domestic partnership agreement is also listing out which parent is going to be getting the tax deductions at whatever point in the future. So let's go to an example now, going back more, Jabalani, to your question. If we're looking at a couple that maybe has a child from a previous relationship, how do we make sure that we're protecting the partner and then onto the child? Well, going back, let's use Bert and Ernie as an example. So Bert comes in and he's got a child. We'll name the child Cookie for Cookie Monster, of course. So we have Bert and Ernie. Bert and Ernie get together. They get married, but they have the child from Bert's original marriage, Cookie. If Bert wants to make sure that his partner, Ernie, is taken care of during his life, we talked about this thing called revocable living trust earlier, and I think it was Debbie who actually set us up perfectly with the example where we can set up that trust so if anything happens to Bert, an income source can go on to Ernie for his health, education, welfare support, lifestyle maintenance. If Ernie's used to getting a Mercedes S550 with cocoa leather interior every year, that trust can be set up in any regard to make sure that Ernie's lifestyle is maintained. Then, once Ernie passes away, we get the opportunity of those assets now passing down to Cookie Monster or Cookie for whatever the life. It can be either an outright distribution or an income stream for Cookie's life from there on, then on out.
Next month, we will be speaking to the Count, who will help us get through our financial planning needs, as well as Big Bird, who will discuss what he feels about Mitt Romney as well.
I needed to throw that in. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. We often hear things about domestic partnership being discriminated against or obstacles in getting benefits. How can you get around that from a financial planning perspective? That's obviously still an issue. JT?
Asking the question a different way to make sure I'm answering the right one. I can talk for hours.
Health benefits, obstacles to getting health benefits for domestic partners, and figuring that into your financial plan.
Oh, okay. Let's actually go back, and I'm going to use New York as a great example. For states that actually allow same-sex marriage, and I'm going to tie this back into unmarried partners in a second, for states that actually allow same-sex marriage or domestic partnerships, almost all of them are coming back now and saying, first of all, whether it be health insurance or any other type of benefit, domestic partners or married partners are going to be allowed that same opportunity. Take it a step further. If we have a pension, so if you have a state employee in the state of New York, if they have a pension, their same-sex spouse would actually be able to get that pension going forward. Comparing and contrasting to a federally, like a federal government employee or a private corporate entity, those pensions are not necessarily protected on for the beneficiary, but a lot more of the bigger companies are coming back and giving that opportunity. My point to that is, go back and ask your HR department, what are the opportunities available for me, and also what are the opportunities available for either my domestic partner or my spouse under a same-sex marriage? Coming backwards, if we do get the opportunity where we can get health insurance, then we have to be aware that on the state level, that's great. We can get the health insurance from the organization. But on the federal level, they're actually going to come back and tax us on that benefit.
Is there any way to get around that, Dan Matthews?
I'm not sure on that particular case. I can't really answer that. Maybe JT would have more insight on that, but I can't answer that.
JT, is there a way to get around getting taxed on this federal level?
Unfortunately, that's going to be at the federal level, which
right.
is governed by DOMA. So until we see DOMA repealed, unfortunately, no, there is no way to get around that. We just have the tax implications. But for a couple that maybe couldn't get health insurance otherwise, you pay a little bit of tax and get the benefit.
Kansas City, if you're living in a domestic partnership of any kind, gay or straight, siblings or parents or extended family, we'd like to hear from you about your experiences in financial planning and your financial planning conundrums. 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also write in your thoughts and questions to our Cash Money Click to Central Standard at kcur.org. Facebook is an option as well. You can also tweet us at kcurcst. Now, JT, we recently saw gay marriage ballot measures pass in Minnesota, your own home state of Maryland. Good for you and your husband. Congratulations. Maine and Washington State. What are the implications of the DOMA Act as it goes before the Supreme Court on, I believe it's November 20th?
Well, the implications are what I was saying at the very the top of the hour, where we're dealing with planning on the state level. Even if we have the same-sex marriage opportunities, we now have to have whatever planning we're doing on the state level work in concert with what we're doing on the federal level, which, again, we're on the federal level, we're planning for legal strangers and making sure that the two are actually tying in. What we're getting as benefits, though, is better access to hospital visitation should one of us become incapacitated, like in a car accident or something along those lines, or some of those benefits we talked about earlier through employers. More importantly, if you come back and you look at even the state of Maryland, my spouse and I, or actually I should say in the state of Maryland, anything that goes to a non-lineal descendant, so anything that passes on at my death, if it doesn't go to my children or my parents, would have the potential for an estate and an inheritance tax. On the state level now, we actually get an unlimited spousal exclusion, so we could miss out on the 10% inheritance tax, as well as I think that Maryland has a 16% estate tax over certain thresholds.
From a financial planning perspective, what are the implications if the DOMA Act passes, certainly, or if the DOMA Act is repealed? Either way, what are the financial planning implications of that?
It'll be interesting to see how that's going to impact a lot of the states. Keep in mind that marriage is actually determined by each state. So, I'm going to kind of digress a little bit and pull it back and say that, in the state of Maryland, my marriage is actually recognized for my spouse and I. Unfortunately, as soon as we cross the bridge to go have dinner with a friend of ours in Virginia, Virginia has very anti-gay or draconian laws when it comes to any types of same-sex privileges or protections. So our protections and privileges are great in the state of Maryland, but as soon as we go into Virginia, we're nothing more than legal strangers again, and if anything, draconian law is going against us. The effects of DOMA are going to be very interesting. I think it's going to lift a lot, but what we have to actually see as a result of that is more states kind of following suit, and I'm seeing a pretty big trend or a pretty big wave of that starting to happen.
So what happens here in Missouri and Kansas, David Jackson, where it's still, as he calls it, legal strangers?
Well, that's where you have to do your extra planning. You got to do those extra steps because you can't make these kind of assumptions that you can in there. So, the living trust idea, making sure your beneficiaries are listed correctly, you have to do those extra steps.
Are life insurance policies becoming more amenable to non-traditional couples, private life insurance policies?
Well, I would say the average individual in America is underinsured, period. Well, that's regardless of. So, but life insurance is one way to guard against, some of those rules that don't fall in your favor. You have a life insurance policy creates that immediate wealth that, those other benefits might have been there for.
Is there something comprehensive in the way of a life insurance policy to eliminate what Dan Matthews called early unintended beneficiaries?
Yeah, one of the most important things you can do with your life insurance policy is, number one, understand who owns it, who the insured is, and who the beneficiary is. And just like we were talking about earlier, where we were talking about payable on death, within a life insurance contract, you can actually name a beneficiary. So you could probably name your domestic partner as your beneficiary, and thus those assets would go directly to them and avoid any kind of unintended beneficial issues.
You still have the estate planning potential problems with ownership of life insurance that you don't have with heterosexual couples, what they have in that. And I would add one other thing that we've talked a lot about planning and trust and so forth. So many people in this country, though, don't have the access to those sorts. And what's the most important item to them is either pensions or Social Security in terms of security, financial security. And it's so important because I think there's some number that I saw, I think JT might be familiar, that about 32% decrease in Social Security benefits on average to couples that aren't married.
And if I could just go back to your question about the financial planning process and how it could change if DOMA is repealed, the process itself won't change. It'll still be the same for every individual that we as planners are trying to help. But we'll probably change are the rules. And it's like right now with some of these states where they do recognize same-sex marriages, you're playing under two different sets of rules, the state-level rules and then the federal rules. So the rules themselves will change, and as planners, you know, we would help our clients guide through those changes. A perfect example is Social Security. Well, right now, Social Security is a federal benefit, and there are no non-spousal benefits to Social Security. So if that then becomes something that can be passed on to a non-traditional couple, then, you know, that's a game changer. And that really changes the planning that we do for individuals to make sure that they're on the right track to retirement independence.
Francie emails in to ask, how do you define transfer on death? Will it allow her beneficiary to avoid probate, and can she do that for a condo?
I believe – go ahead. Well,
JT?
I was going to say – go ahead, JT.
I was going to say the TODs or transfer on death are actually – it comes from something called the Totten Trust many years back. And TODs work very, very efficiently when it comes to investment or checking accounts. They don't necessarily work very effectively, or actually they don't work at all when you're dealing with real property. So the short answer to that is no. But then the next step to that is what I found is if you look at corporate banks and, you know, any of your big tiered banks that are on every street corner and they're around the world, they don't typically allow a TOD opportunity. They don't want the liability challenges that go with it. If, however, you're dealing with a credit unions most of the time will actually allow you to do that, but that way you do have the opportunity for avoiding probate.
Our guests are Cash Money Click of Financial Advisors, David Jackson, Dan Matthews, Alex Petrovic, and J.T. Hatfield-Charles, an ambassador for the Certified Financial Planner Board of Standards, calling in from Maryland. Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For today's show.
Thank you, J.T.
And tune in tomorrow as we discuss Irma Vep, a horrifically funny play showing on the downtown stage at the KC Rep. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander. Up to Date is next with a look at Future Perfect, the case for progress in a network age. That plus a look at Truman Capote's time in Kansas. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.